though well-received after the failures of the George W. Bush administration, had gone unfulfilled to the point of fueling the Trump fires of discontent. Obama might be impeccably cultured, conversationally fluent, and polished and presentable, but after his 8 years in office, the country felt more divided than before and in a state of decline. While there was no great warmth of affection between the Clintons and the Obamas, they locked arms, mounted their soapboxes, and rang the alarm bells in opposition to a mighty ogre who represented a categorical rejection of their joint incumbency and of the politically correct groupthink of the liberal elite. The heyday of fear and smear was at hand, and the enemy was not a gentleman or an amateur. The Clintons and Obama faced far more than they bargained for. For the Democrats to turn the tables on Trump's rhetoric about Muslims, given the high level of public concern about the admission of Islamic terrorists or people who were apt to become radicalized once inside the country, the Democrats sent to the podium Khizr Khan, a lawyer who had emigrated from Pakistan in 1980, and his wife Ghazala. Their son, Humayun, had died in Iraq in 2004 in a suicide bombing while serving in the U.S. Army, and had been posthumously awarded a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. Mr. Khan spoke of his son and objected to the earlier Trump proposals to ban Muslim immigration, saying, "If it was up to Donald Trump, his son would have never been in America." Mr. Khan spoke calmly and graciously and asked if Trump had ever read the Constitution and produced a copy from his pocket and offered somewhat gratuitously to lend it to Trump. Mr. Khan concluded that Trump had sacrificed nothing and no one. It was a reasonable effort to snag Trump on his earlier reckless call for a temporary ban on the admission of Muslims to America. But it was also a rather shabby exploitation of natural sympathy for any family that has lost someone in war, serving with distinction in the country's uniform. The next week, on a political television interview program, ABC's George Stephanopoulos raised the subject, and Trump replied that Mr. Khan looked like a nice guy to me. Trump wondered if Mrs. Khan did not speak because she was not allowed to speak. Stephanopoulos asked what Trump had sacrificed for his country, and he replied that he had worked very hard, created many thousands of jobs, built some very fine buildings and projects, and added his work for and contributions to veterans' causes, including a Vietnam memorial in Manhattan. Trump was heavily criticized, including by a significant number of Republicans, for belittling Mr. Khan, and his polls slipped generally by several points. Speaker Paul Ryan was always among the first Republicans to wring his hands over Trump's less guarded reflections, and on this occasion he said they were beyond the pale. Trump declined to endorse Ryan's reelection after Ryan said Trump's nomination was not a blank check. Trump, never a believer in unilateral verbal disarmament, dismissed the Khan controversy. He said that Khan was being ferried about the entire country as a Democratic campaign speaker and had attacked him, Trump, and pointed out that the story was not about Mr. Khan, but about radical Islamist terrorism in the U.S. Khan was effective initially for the Democrats, but Trump issued a further statement that Mr. Khan's son was a hero to our country, and we should honor all who have made the ultimate sacrifice to make our country safe. While I feel deeply for the loss of his son, Mr. Khan, who has never met me, has no right to stand in front of millions of people and say I have never read the Constitution, which is false, and say many other inaccurate things. In the second of the presidential debates, when the subject came up again, Trump said that Captain Khan would still be alive today if I had been president in 2004. The issue subsided without lasting effect. I debated with Mr. Khan in Britain shortly after the inauguration of the new administration. He was very courteous and amiable and sincere in thinking Trump was hostile to Muslims, but completely inflexible and repetitive in his inaccurate opinions. We parted cordially. Hillary and the others weren't as good at throwing invective around as Trump was, and they didn't have as vulnerable a target as he had when he attacked their performance in office. She couldn't separate herself from the flatlined economy and massive debt increases of Obama without splitting her party, which was fragile enough after the tremendous charge of Bernie Sanders, whose voters Trump was pitching to with his claim that Sanders had been schlonged, New York Yiddish for screwed, which was lingua franca Sanders and Trump both knew from their upbringing in the outer boroughs of New York City. If the Republicans had had their popular New York mayor speak to their convention, Rudolph W. Giuliani, the Democrats had theirs with Michael R. Bloomberg. Bloomberg had initially thrown in his lot with Jeb Bush, angling for the position of Secretary of State. And when that campaign imploded, largely under the Trumpian onslaught against low-energy Jeb, Bloomberg had cast his lot with Clinton. He had run for mayor of New York originally as a Republican, only the fifth Republican mayor of New York in 100 years. But Bloomberg had become an independent, and as of his appearance at the Democratic convention, a Democrat. Bloomberg called Trump a fraud who had inherited his money. Untrue, and in any case not a bad thing, and had much less money than he claimed to have and was a con. Bloomberg is a much wealthier man than Trump. Apparently his company is worth around $35 billion, and has had a relatively uncontroversial and brilliantly successful career. Bloomberg, 73, risked his entire political future, such as it was, on Clinton winning. He gambled, and for once, he lost. Mayors of important cities have rarely done well in American history. Only Grover Cleveland, who had been mayor of Buffalo, was elected president, and the only other nominees who have been mayors were DeWitt Clinton of New York City in 1812 and Hubert Humphrey of Minneapolis in 1968. The campaign was off and running and promised to be one of the nastiest in American history. On August 2nd, President Obama, speaking at a press conference with the Prime Minister of Singapore, said, "The Republican nominee is unfit to serve as president. He keeps showing it." He repeatedly claimed that Trump favored the Ku Klux Klan, a monstrous outrage. On the same day, the Koch brothers, who reportedly raised and contributed more than $800 million for the 2016 elections, announced that they were not supporting Donald Trump. Also on the same day, Trump expressed the fear that the election could be rigged with the votes of illegal aliens. Obama dismissed this, saying, "There is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that you could even rig America's elections." A few months later, he and almost everyone in his party were suggesting that the election had been rigged by the Russians. August 2nd was an especially eventful news day. Typical of national media denigration of the Trump campaign, when the candidate joked after a baby cried in its mother's arms at one of his rallies on that day, and he suggested having the infant ejected, CNN and other networks claimed that he had actually threatened to have the baby forcibly removed from the rally. Trump regaled his tens of millions of Twitter followers with this report as indicative of the media's dishonesty, and drew huge applause over it from his very large campaign crowds. The Democratic candidate, massively financed and organized, and supported by most of the media, poured out every lurid detail of Trump University. The illegally admitted and underpaid Polish workers at the Trump Tower building site, the supposed racial discrimination of Trump and his father as landlords, tax returns Trump refused to make public, contrary to modern tradition, though he claimed he would do so when the challenges to them by the IRS had been resolved, the many bankruptcies with their screw jobs on debt holders and rough treatment of some employees, and the less specific allegations of whipping up hostility to immigrants and Latin Americans and Muslims. Hillary Clinton and the Democratic campaign orators, including former Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, roasted him every day for 15 weeks as a mendacious hypocrite. On August 3rd, Trump lost an important judgment on the Trump University case, rendered by Judge Gonzalo Curiel, whom he had already suggested was biased because of his Latin American heritage. The next day, Melania Trump debunked claims that she had once worked illegally as a model in the United States. And the following day, as Karl Rove, President George W. Bush's political manager, compared Trump's electoral position to that of Walter Mondale, who lost 49 states to Ronald Reagan in 1984, the BBC, always anti-American and especially hostile to Republicans, proclaimed Trump campaign on the brink and asked, should Donald Trump throw in the towel before the inevitable November knockout? On August 7th, Ohio Governor John Kasich declined to say if he would support Trump, whose campaign he described as disturbing and alarming, and predicted he would not win Ohio. On August 9th, Evan McMullen, a former national security advisor to the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives, ran as an independent in Utah, with the declared object of splitting that state's Republican vote and delivering it to Clinton. Trump made no effort as the campaign progressed to moderate the predictable impact some of his foibles would have on the country. He continued to refuse to release his tax returns. And he gave passing attention to some rather wingy conspiracy theories, such as that President Obama was secretly a Muslim, and that conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia had not died from natural causes. Trump was easily portrayed as a credulous reader of shabby tabloid media. He was also an omnivorous reader of newspapers, addicted to controversy, showmanship, and hucksterism. And there was some truth in that. But his endless barrage of tweets, aside from showing how little he slept and driving his critics to paroxysms of outrage, both stirred up his supporters and acted as a counterbalance to the hostility of the media. Unctuous and self-important groups of establishment Republican thinkers and former officials solemnly produced petitions and open letters denouncing Trump, which were often jubilantly highlighted in the New York Times. These pundits, almost none of whom actually knew Donald Trump, proclaimed he was unsuited to govern. One group, whose warning surfaced on August 8th, declared that Trump would be the most reckless president in American history, would weaken the United States' moral authority, and disputed that Trump knew about or believed in the Constitution, and stated that Trump had demonstrated repeatedly that he has little understanding of the nation's vital national interests, its complex diplomatic challenges, its indispensable alliances and democratic values, and added, with immense condescension, that Mr. Trump has shown no interest in educating himself. The conclusion, like a child stamping his foot, was that none of us will vote for Donald Trump, although they volunteered that many of us have doubts about Hillary Clinton. It was such an ineffably pompous document, Trump almost certainly gained support when he promptly replied that the signatories were the ones the American people should look to for answers on why the world is a mess, and we thank them for coming forward so everyone in the country knows who deserves the blame for making the world such a dangerous place. He dismissed them as the failed Washington elite, trying to hang on to power, and correctly identified them as largely implicated in the debacle of the Iraq War, and of having been associated with the campaigns of people that he defeated in the primaries. They piously repeated the usual Clinton mantra that Trump was temperamentally unsuited to the office he was seeking, that he does not encourage conflicting views, lacks self-control, and acts impetuously. He cannot tolerate personal criticism, and declared that he could not be trusted with nuclear weapons. They also tried to make the case that Trump's use of the slogan America First implied fascist sympathies. It was an impenetrably fatuous outburst of snobbery from a very tired and generally second-rate congeries of former junior officials few members of the public could identify or remember. A number of them had very or at least somewhat distinguished careers, such as Ken Edelman, Ellen Bork, Tom Donnelly, Neil Ferguson, Robert Kagan, Michael Mukasey, John Negroponte, Daniel Pipes, and Robert Zoellick. But most were irrational zealots like Max Boot, insufferable snobs like Elliot Cohen, or just tired hacks of the kind that are always numerous and vocal in Washington. A few Republican legislators followed in the same line, including Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. It was all pretty stuffy and pretentious. Trump irritated many, and often did himself no favors with his flippancy and his indiscriminate references to quack ideas, but there was no reason to dispute his sanity, disparage his intelligence, or imply that these petitioners were anything more than a washed-out group of mediocrities, partisans, and frightened establishment Republicans. This and some similar exercises in self-importance had no discernible impact on the race. As it heated up, the campaign was unedifying and rarely substantive, but rarely dull. Less statesmanship than entertainment, which was Trump's forte. Chapter 8, Race to the Wire. At Wilmington, North Carolina, on August 9th, Trump accused Hillary Clinton of seeking to repeal Americans' constitutional right to bear arms through her gun control proposals. This was a serious exaggeration, but not an uncommon one in political campaigns. He said, "If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although with the Second Amendment people, maybe there is." Without asking for clarification on what he meant, the jackals in the pro-Clinton media reported he had called for Mrs. Clinton's assassination. He clarified that he was only referring to the well-known and frequently demonstrated political influence of Second Amendment enthusiasts and their chief lobbying arm, the National Rifle Association, to get their way. The Democrats and their media allies would not let it go in their desire to exploit what they thought a vulnerability of Trump's about incitement to violence. Tom Friedman, the absurdly partisan Democratic sympathizer, who comments on national and international affairs, very predictably in the New York Times, wrote, "And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how Yitzhak Rabin got assassinated." It was a false and scurrilous statement. But it is doubtful that this controversy had any lasting impact because it was so manifestly untrue. In fact, it would eventually be proven to be the reverse of the truth, as liberals themselves delighted in publicly imagining Trump's assassination. Still, Trump did not help himself by adding in September that Mrs. Clinton's Secret Service details should disarm themselves and let's see what happens. Trump was not promoting violence at all. In this case, he was trying to underline the effectiveness of guns for personal protection. But his belligerent spirit of, "we won't take it anymore," which appealed to tens of millions of people, was easily construed by those who viscerally disliked his strident egotism and bluntness as betraying a tendency to violence. Most of these controversies, based on different interpretations of ambiguous statements, reinforced people where they were and did not move large blocks of opinion durably in one direction or another. Trump, too, was on the offensive every day of the campaign. On August 11th, he referred to Obama and Hillary Clinton as co-founders of ISIS. The anti-Trump media went through their ponderous fact-checking process to establish that the accusation was not literally true, as if Trump had claimed that Obama and Clinton had personally set up an organization calling for a new Muslim caliphate. There were widespread media reports on August 11th that Reince Priebus had threatened to withhold Republican National Committee funds from Trump and consign them to Republican candidates for other offices. There was no actual evidence to support this allegation. It was vehemently denied on all sides and was one of the early egregious examples of what Trump called fake news. On August 16th, 123 people who claimed to be Republicans, including two congressmen, Reid Ribble and Scott Ridgel, eight former congressmen and 27 former members of the Republican National Committee, signed a petition making the request that the media had already attributed to Priebus. The petition declared that Donald Trump's chances of being elected are evaporating by the day, and excoriated his campaign of anger and exclusion, which has mocked and offended millions of voters, including the disabled, women, Muslims, immigrants, and minorities, and shown dangerous authoritarian tendencies, and favored illegal and unconstitutional measures. It was pretty hysterical, and RNC Chairman Priebus rightly ignored the petition when it arrived. By this time, the country was well aware of the negatives of both candidates and of the Republican establishment's hostility to Trump. In the Trump-led counteroffensive, the Clintons were represented as sleazy operators of a pay-to-play casino that had transformed the Clinton Foundation into a straight influence-peddling operation, where Canadian businessman Frank Giustra had pledged $131 million, and Russian-interested parties paid Bill Clinton $500,000 for a canned speech in Moscow as rewards for President Clinton's assistance in negotiating and Secretary Clinton's offering her approval under national security requirements of a lucrative sale of substantial American uranium resources to Russian and Kazakhstan interests. Trump charged official corruption and emphasized the problems with Mrs. Clinton's emails. Clinton alleged unethical business practices by Trump. There was some truth to both sides, and Trump seemed narrowly to get the better of it, if for no other reason than that the questionable Clinton Foundation antics involved much larger sums than did the controversy over Trump University. and her public service misconduct involved far more serious breaches of ethics and possibly the law than anything Trump had been plausibly accused of in the conduct of his myriad businesses. It was a bare-knuckles battle from start to end. Clinton carried the banner for women out to break the ultimate glass ceiling and also accused Trump of misogyny, which, given his track record in employing women, including his campaign manager, was hard to sustain. He came back with explicit attacks on the peccadilloes and wild indiscretions of President Clinton, accusing Hillary of being an enabler who had dismissed accusations of sexual harassment and worse against her husband as coming from bimbos. In the opening stages of the campaign, Trump generally got the better of that exchange, too. But Clinton scored more heavily with allegations of hostility to non-whites, which was an easy if cheap shot to make, given Trump's support for enforcing and tightening the nation's immigration laws, and mocking his complete political inexperience. He righteously denied the charge of racism and came back quite strongly, accusing her of complicity in failing to defend America's border with Mexico, and of pandering to millions of illegal immigrants, whom she hoped to turn into Democratic voters. He chided her inability to utter the words Islamist extremism and condemned her as a foreign policy failure as Secretary of State. This was a close match. Clinton had the edge in experience and precise knowledge of policy issues and took full advantage of Trump's tendency to overclaim, overaccuse, and oversimplify. The Clintons and the Democrats played the game of identity politics to those groups they liked to consider their own, ethnic minorities, women, public employees unions, but there was also a large body of moderate opinion that was comfortable with the Clintons, who were a known political quantity and undoubtedly experienced and competent and in no sense extreme. Hillary Clinton had not had any great impact as a senator or secretary of state, but at least she knew the ropes of government. Because of his tendencies to shoot from the hip and throw haymakers with every sentence, Trump delighted those disposed to agree with him, but appalled skeptics and worried the judicious. Essentially, both candidates had huge negatives. Neither was trusted personally, and both had natural followings. But Trump had many more true believers because of his engaging style and the depths of resentment against the political establishment. He reaped the benefit of being a complete outsider, but he was also the less knowledgeable candidate. He replied to the charge of inexperience that Hillary Clinton's experience was that of someone steeped to the eyeballs in bad and failed policy. It became a titanic struggle between Mrs. Clinton and the Democrats' ability to represent Trump as a crooked and half-mad egotist and imposter, and his ability to rouse resentment against the Clintons as personifications of the decline of America while they immersed themselves in financial greed and the moral hypocrisy of Bill Clinton's philandering like a rutting panther while she strutted the country as a priggish scold and virtue-sodden feminist. In the early days of the campaign and at stages through it, I was on American television news comment shows, essentially as a token source of the view that Trump was not a completely implausible candidate. Early on, I encountered a barrage of well-known Democrats so confident that they demanded to know why the respectable elements of the Republican Party had not deserted their nominee as they had Goldwater in 1964. I stated the obvious, that the positions of the two Republican candidates and the stature of the two Democrats were hardly comparable. Goldwater was effectively opposed to federal civil rights legislation and appeared to be contemplating a greater level of escalation in the Vietnam War than the country was comfortable with, and President Johnson was well respected. There were massive allegations that Trump was lying whenever his lips moved, and opposition media regularly released what they purported to regard as authenticated lists of Trump's falsehoods. PolitiFact, a partisan political fact checker, had already declared him the author of the lie of the year of 2015 through an uncountable multiplicity of lies, and asserted that 76% of Trump's assertions were mostly false, false outright, or pants-on-fire lies. Trump would win this distinction again in 2017. Norman Ornstein of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute gave a more sober appraisal, that Trump was a graduate of a milieu, the New York real estate development industry, as well as the world of television virtual reality, where the truth was routinely departed from, and that Trump, the grand impresario, had entered an environment that was ripe for bombastic, inflammatory, outrageous statements without having to suffer the consequences, where extreme partisanship, public cynicism, general disregard for traditional expertise, and accumulated public anger did not discourage his natural tendencies to hyperbole and did not really punish lapses into fabrication. Other less partisan observers counseled caution and warned that Trump often insinuates things without stating them and engaged in deliberate vagueness, leaving him, in the words of past American political controversies, plausible deniability. Trump also had the improvident knack of enabling his opponents to impute to him an unseemly respect for undemocratic leaders. That, in turn, assisted them in implying that he had anti-democratic tendencies himself. Trump frequently expressed respect for Russian leader Vladimir Putin, saying that he could be a valued ally in fighting ISIS, and that he was a much stronger and more astute leader than Obama. Almost certainly true, but untimely and not strictly relevant. He was skeptical of Obama administration and Democratic Party claims that Putin was behind the release of stolen U.S. government intelligence, or the hacked DNC emails published by WikiLeaks, or conducting a cyber war against Hillary Clinton. This played into the natural Democratic claim that Trump and his campaign collaborators had had compromising business dealings with Russia. No one seemed to foresee how quickly this sort of charge would grow into a dangerous monster lurching about the American political landscape. Trump also said that while disapproving the severity of the Chinese government in suppressing the Tiananmen Square occupiers, he recognized their strength and purposefulness in doing so, and considered the occupiers of the country's principal public space to be demonstrators. He was practically correct. The regime of Deng Xiaoping did not fold as the Shah of Iran did, and no government could tolerate the country's main square being occupied indefinitely by dissidents. But as is so often the case with Donald Trump, his selection of the words to express his views was far from optimal. Not without eventual irony, he said of the maniac Kim Jong-un that he deserved credit for liquidating rivals to his authority. He even gave Saddam Hussein credit for taking out domestic terrorists, without suggesting that Saddam was a terrorist himself. The spontaneity Donald Trump had always had of putting out his views unsubtly and without regard to the range of possible interpretations of them, especially by opponents, created unnecessary problems for him. He commended Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan for putting down an attempted coup d'etat, and made the perhaps correct point that Iraq and Libya would be better off if Saddam and Gaddafi had been left in power in those countries. On August 17th, the media widely credited the opinion of far-left filmmaker and general misfit Michael Moore that Trump is purposely sabotaging his campaign because he never wanted to be president. It is illustrative of the poor quality of media coverage that such nonsense from such a silly source was circulated seriously as a news story. This sort of ill-founded speculation, and a new example occurred every few days, assisted Trump in reviling the national media as untrustworthy and partisan, which was certainly true. It was as this story was spread across the country that Kellyanne Conway was formally confirmed as campaign manager. Trump had had three managers in 6 months, but his campaign was a fairly smooth professional operation by now, although he was spending much less than Clinton and had a relatively small entourage. Trump always maintained that these campaigns, like governments themselves, were vastly overstaffed. On August 25th, the British leader of the successful campaign to leave the European Union, Nigel Farage, spoke at a Trump rally in Jackson, Mississippi, and said, "I wouldn't vote for Clinton if you paid me." On August 31st, Trump met with the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, and they had a very civilized discussion about Trump's concerns over illegal immigration and the trade gap between the two countries. Peña Nieto stressed that he had also invited Secretary Clinton to visit, but that she had declined. He pledged to stay entirely out of the American election process. Trump went from Mexico to Phoenix and there delivered a thoughtful and thorough speech about his immigration policy, which, in a familiar pattern, was panned by most of the media as racist. On September 3rd, he spoke to a pan-evangelical meeting in Detroit and gave a very moderate address outlining policy areas where he thought the federal government could be much more useful to the African-American community. The Los Angeles Times, University of Southern California, and Rasmussen polls, considered as outliers by the political establishment, steadily showed the candidates neck and neck. Trump did not campaign in California, New York, or Illinois, where it was assumed Clinton would rack up heavy majorities, and he did not spend too much time in states where he was expected to win easily, even large states such as Texas. He concentrated heavily on a number of quite large states where he had to win, or there seemed to be a possibility that he could win, despite them being traditionally Democratic states. It was assumed that Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio would be relatively close, and Trump had to win them all, with 64 electoral votes, to have a chance of election. He also focused on Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which were long shots, but there were undoubtedly many discontented working-class voters who thought their Democratic Party had been taken over by the liberal elite, millennial progressives, and left-leaning minority activist groups, and that they had been forsaken. Trump directed his message to them and demonstrated his immense stamina with a punishing campaign schedule through those states. Presidents had been elected 5 times before with fewer votes than their chief opponents, and Trump was clearly trying to game the electoral system to do it again. There were persistent questions about Mrs. Clinton's health, especially when, on September 11th, she fainted within camera view while returning to her car after a ceremony marking the anniversary of the 2001 terrorist attacks. After an initial attempt to cover it up, and once the footage leaked, her campaign acknowledged that she had been suffering from a bout of walking pneumonia. In the medical circumstances, her perseverance was admirable. But what was seen was her physical infirmity in comparison with her apparently inexhaustible opponent, who seemed never to tire. Hillary Clinton made a serious tactical error on September 9th when she told an LGBT fundraiser with Barbara Streisand at New York Cipriani restaurant that, "You can put half of Trump supporters into what I call a basket of deplorables, right? Racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. Unfortunately, there are people like that, and he has lifted them up. He has given voice to their websites that used to have only 11,000 people and now have 11 million. He tweets and retweets offensive, mean-spirited, hateful rhetoric." She added that some of these people were irredeemable and not America. In part, she was pitching to her non-straight audience, which had no valid grievance with Trump, and in part, she was expressing frustration that her solid media support was not opening a cavernous lead for her because of Trump's dominance of social media and the talk shows. Trump had made no homophobic comments, and his only complaints about immigration were illegal entrants and incipient terrorists. Clinton backtracked 2 days later, saying she had grossly overgeneralized. But Trump and his team hammered her across the country as an elitist infected with the bigotry of a failed establishment class, now frightened and desperately trying to retain its incumbency through smears and demagogy. Trump revealed a thoughtful child care policy, partly drafted by his daughter Ivanka, who was just about as startlingly beautiful and stylish as her stepmother. But the media paid little attention because it did not fit their narrative. The next day, there came something that did. Trump called a press conference to bury the nonsense about where Obama was born once and for all, but did so by claiming that the allegation was originally made by Hillary Clinton, and that he, Donald Trump, had resolved it by compelling the president to produce his birth certificate. Then, without skipping a beat, he introduced a group of highly decorated veterans of the armed forces who supported him, but had nothing to do with the birther controversy, inane as it was. 4 days later, Trump met with the president of Egypt, General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who had not been impressed by the Bush-Obama demand for free elections in Egypt. After the Muslim Brotherhood won the election, el-Sisi was also unimpressed by the championship of the Brotherhood by Obama and Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham, virtually conducting their own foreign policy, and all asking for great deference to the Brotherhood. This was an astonishing bipartisan display of bottomless political naivete. Trump and el-Sisi had a very cordial discussion, and as with his meeting with the Mexican president, the meeting with el-Sisi reinforced the seriousness of Trump's candidacy and his ability to speak knowledgeably with foreign leaders. Trump had rarely spoken from a text, and while his spontaneous addresses were often rollicking occasions, they were discursive, and the media was generally unconvinced that he had any ability to give a prepared and sequentially coherent direct speech. However, his first such address, a foreign policy speech on April 27th, and his address to the Republican Convention, a blood-curdling partisan effort, were both coherent and apparently effective. But it was generally assumed that in a debate, Trump, with his impressionistic and undisciplined style and lack of detailed familiarity with most policy issues, would be at a heavy disadvantage to Mrs. Clinton, who had been a policy wonk and high office holder for many years. The first of the three debates between the presidential candidates was at Hofstra University in New York on September 26th. Trump started well, but Clinton clearly won the last half of the debate, though not catastrophically so for Trump. There was an all-time record of 84 million American viewers. Trump did expose the moderator, Lester Holt, of his old network NBC, as another partisan pseudo-neutral when he switched roles with Clinton and debated Trump about the police habit of random stop and frisk, a practice that Trump endorsed as necessary to reduce the level of violent crime. Holt claimed that it was declared unconstitutional by New York courts as largely singling out African Americans and Hispanics. Trump responded with exact knowledge that this was a New York verdict by an anti-police judge that the new leftist mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, had refused to appeal, but that in many other American communities, stop and frisk was entirely legal and frequently imposed. Trump won the exchange and emerged well above the low bar the Democrats and their media allies had set for him as an inarticulate and ignorant windbag. It was still generally thought to be a Clinton win, but without any clangorous misstatement or revelation of extremist or uninformed views by Trump that came remotely close to forfeiting the election. But no one would know that from watching the debate coverage on CNN or MSNBC, where Trump's total collapse was reported on a daily basis throughout the campaign. Clinton had championed former winner of Trump's Miss Universe contest, Alicia Machado, whom Trump had taken issue with when she put on a good deal of weight during her reign as Miss Universe. Ms. Machado accused Trump of being like Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez and the inevitable Adolf Hitler, and was recruited as a Clinton campaign spokesperson. There were unctuous complaints about Trump's ungentlemanly remarks, but there were no votes on this one for Clinton. Most polls showed the Clinton lead opened up slightly for a few days, but then narrowed again to 2-4%. That could be a 6-7 million plurality, and if the margin in California, New York, and Illinois came close, as was indicated, to accounting for such a lead, it still possessed the potential to be a cliffhanger election. Even at this late stage, with barely a month to go, there was no sign of Clinton pulling away. On October 7th, WikiLeaks released a series of transcripts outlining Clinton's deep connections with Wall Street, many of them from very well-paid speeches, including one to Latin American bankers, where she put all her cards on the table for free trade and unrestricted immigration. Taking these comments with remarks released from an address to New York bankers, the picture emerged of Hillary Clinton as a rather conventional globalist leftist, happy to use trade agreements as a way of equalizing income with poorer countries, and an ardent green crusader, but in both cases finessing it in public, given the realities of public opinion. To the Latin Americans, she said, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders sometime in the future, with energy that is as green and sustainable as we can get it, powering growth and opportunity for every person in the hemisphere." To the Wall Streeters, she said, "Politics is like sausage being made. It is unsavory, and it always has been that way. But we usually end up where we need to be. But if everybody's watching, you know, all of the backroom discussions and the deals, you know, people get a little nervous, to say the least. So you need both a public and a private position. Her opening of the policy kimono to the Latin Americans was incautious and a debatable take on the national interest. The fact that she had been highly paid to say such things to these audiences exposed her as a rank hypocrite, both cynical and naive. This would have been a bigger source of damage to her candidacy than it was if the Democrats had not decided on this day to explode their largest grenade, the now infamous Billy Bush tape. With a month left, Trump was right on the back of Clinton in the polls. On October 7th, when it must have been thought to be too late for Trump to recover from it, the Washington Post, having been fed it by NBC, released an audio video of a conversation between Trump and another member of the ubiquitous Bush family, Billy Bush of NBC from 2005, in which Trump offered the lewd reflection that a celebrity, by virtue of his status, can get away with almost anything with women, including grabbing them by the pussy. The media and the Democrats, generally more or less coextensive groups, erupted in righteous outrage, as did many of the Republicans who had been looking for an excuse to desert their party's candidate anyway. The party chairman, Reince Priebus, ran for cover and all but disowned Trump. So did Mitt Romney, who had already blasted Trump as totally unqualified and altogether a bad man. To which Trump responded by reminiscing about Romney beseeching him for financial assistance in the presidential campaign 4 years before, when Romney had been the electorally incompetent nominee. Speaker Paul Ryan, whose support of Trump had been extremely tenuous and frequently withdrawn as if by a person tempting an animal with a treat, announced that he was sickened by the remarks and disinvited Trump from a joint public appearance they were going to make in Wisconsin in a few days. After brief further reflection, Ryan said he would no longer defend or support Trump's campaign, not that he had done much of either, and authorized all Republican congressmen to take as much distance as they wished from the nominee. Aghast and supercilious murmurings in the New York City and Washington, D.C. salons parroted the indignant fulminations from highbrow commentators, who insisted in unison that Trump's lewd remarks were so boorish they disqualified him from being president. It was all ahistorical revisionist bunk. Lyndon B. Johnson, John F. Kennedy, and William J. Clinton, among other occupants of the White House, engaged in conduct so lascivious, exhibitionistic, and indecent, it would have made Billy Bush blush. Melania Trump referred to her husband's remarks. They were just married when Trump made the comments, but had been together intimately for 7 years before that, as offensive and inappropriate, but not currently relevant to her or to election issues. Trump himself issued a video statement after a few hours stating that, "Anyone who knows me knows these words do not reflect who I am. I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize." He continued, "There's a big difference between the words and actions. Bill Clinton has actually abused women, and Hillary has bullied, attacked, shamed, and intimidated his victims." This was a bold gambit from the great counterpuncher. The Clintons retained a moral silence, happy enough to have the latest WikiLeaks revelations overshadowed. But the noisiest spokespeople among the anti-Trumpers shrieked like jungle parrots that Trump must not be seriously considered for the country's highest office. And perhaps 24 Republican candidates at different levels renounced support for the Trump candidacy. Among them were Senators Ayotte, New Hampshire, Crapo, Idaho, Fisher, Nebraska, Flake, Arizona, Gardner, Colorado, Kirk, Illinois, Lee, Utah, McCain, Arizona, Murkowski, Alaska, Portman, Ohio, Thune, South Dakota, Toomey, Pennsylvania, a sprinkling of congressmen and governors, including Kasich, and a few quasi-luminaries of the past, such as former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. They could be called, in a famous Hollywood phrase from Casablanca, the usual suspects. And for few of them was it anything but a happy and even vindictive leave-taking. Trump's comments were certainly very damaging, coming so indiscreetly to a media person from a 59-year-old billionaire who was an educated man, well brought up in a civilized and traditional Presbyterian family, and at a military academy where young men are taught to be officers and gentlemen. No one wants or expects a male presidential candidate to be a eunuch or a prude, but this was a serious lapse of judgment, even for a man who was at the time a celebrity and not a candidate. What he had said had nothing to do with being president, but he apologized for it, and he deserved to have his apology, which must have been sincere in the electoral circumstances, accepted. There was also the other matter Trump was about to elaborate, of the difference between idle talk about sex and unseemly or even criminal sexual activity. The next debate was 2 days later, and Trump started out on the afternoon of the debate with a press conference with three women who had given affidavit evidence that Bill Clinton had attempted to force himself upon them sexually, with varying degrees of success, and a fourth woman, Kathy Shelton, a victim of violent rape whose assailant had been acquitted because of his counsel Hillary Clinton's manipulative use of criminal procedure, a matter Hillary Clinton had been recorded boasting about amid laughter. Trump developed his theme with his usual theatrics about idle, unserious observations by himself 11 years before and the flagrant delicts of his opponent's husband, whom she had facilitated and who was now proposing to return to his old hunting ground in the People's House, the White House. Trump had ignored the demands that he withdraw in favor of Pence and took the position that what he had said to Billy Bush was an aberration, locker room talk from many years before, that he had apologized for it, and that none of it had anything to do with this election. It seemed that both campaigns had been prepared. The Democrats' friends in the media had unleashed their secret weapon, and Trump had his countercharge, that the Clintons were the most hypocritical, unvirtuous couple in American presidential history. This had been, from the start, such a shabby campaign that the blow was not a mortal one for Trump, though it was a heavy hit. None of the participants in presidential debates going back to 1960 had been under as much pressure as Trump was now in this second debate, with many of his most influential partisans calling for him to withdraw from the race. Most commentators thought that the best Trump could do now was to salvage his presidential candidacy, staving off calls that he step aside for Pence, and then go down to an inevitable, decisive, but not unprecedentedly one-sided defeat in the election. The candidates entered the debating arena at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, without shaking hands and in a clearly grim atmosphere of total war. Trump's entire campaign was on a knife edge. His was a boffo performance. Trump was calm, clear, spoke fluently and on subject, sidestepped the Billy Bush fiasco with remarkable agility, dismissing it as the dirty tricks of his opponents to introduce a red herring like this at the end of the campaign. He had apologized, and that was the end of it. He regained the offensive in references to the Clinton Foundation's pay-to-play activities, and Hillary's alleged dishonesty about her tens of thousands of deleted emails. He promised a special prosecutor to look into the murky area of the Clintons' activities. And when she said, "It is awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country," he interjected, "because you'd be in jail," which was hilarious, but of course outraged the humorless media, who alleged hysterically that Trump was acting like a Latin American dictator threatening to jail his opponents, when in fact he was facetiously but effectively standing up for the rule of law to which Hillary was apparently immune. It was a superb performance throughout the debate. There is disagreement among polls about who won, and most polls were, as events proved, skewed to be pro-Clinton anyway. But even Clintonians acknowledged that Trump had done well. Under intense pressure, Donald Trump had clearly saved his candidacy from collapse and was still in the race. He had shown the same icy and confident determination under terrible pressure that he did at the worst of his simultaneous financial and marital crises in 1990. In her Goebbels-like whitewash of an election memoir, Hillary Clinton claims to have been the author of a magnificent clutch performance because of Trump's attempt to get inside my mind. In fact, all she had to do was show up, and she still only managed to debate her way to, at best, a draw. Trump was certainly still trailing, but Republican Party Chairman Priebus rallied to him based entirely on Trump's debate performance. Vice Presidential Mike Pence, who had been ominously quiet for 2 days, tweeted his congratulations and continued support. Proud to be with you in this campaign. It had been rumored that Kellyanne Conway had quit as campaign manager, but she tweeted a photo on Melania's iPhone that showed the three, she, Melania, and Donald Trump, riding together in good spirits to the debate. Other Republican spokespeople were quite buoyant after the debate in their television interviews. The Democrats came back with specific allegations of their own against Trump of harassment of women, among a movement of opportune complainants coming out of the woodwork after many years. Jill Harth had filed a suit against him in 1997, alleging groping of her private parts and relentless harassment. Trump denied all of it with his customary strenuousness. Mudslinging darkened the skies and filled the media. The battle was a straight reciprocal character assassination. Every issue was now magnified to present Trump as a quasi-fascist revolutionary directing street thugs to bring the wheels of democracy to a grinding halt if he did not win. He regularly suggested that the political system, not to mention the election, was rigged with, among other things, the media acting as Democratic propagandists, which was demonstrably true. Trump continued to counter this with his dominance of social media and talk radio. Lively and exotic blogger and television commentator Ann Coulter, a strong Trump supporter throughout the campaign, occasionally presented the election as a crusade not to inflict upon America the spectacle of Hillary wallowing around the White House in her neon pantsuits for 8 years. Trump denounced Hillary Clinton as Crooked Hillary, as he had effectively attacked his primary opponents as Little Marco Rubio, Lion Ted Cruz, and Low Energy Jeb Bush. By all traditional standards, Donald Trump should not have gotten past the early primaries, and was not expected to, and should not be a serious contender now, but he was. Trump slathered the national media relentlessly as liars and lackeys of all those in both parties who had failed the nation, and now wrote petitions about Trump's mental health and ethics. On October 11th, a WikiLeaks dump of purloined or hacked emails revealed that media commentator, former presidential primary debate chair, and Democratic National Committee official Donna Brazile had leaked questions to Mrs. Clinton in advance of a candidate's debate. The media shuffled and fumbled through their embarrassment at this naked bias for Clinton over Sanders. Again, Trump hammered it very hard and humorlessly to his large audiences, taking full advantage of the high exposure the media had to give him in search of viewers in this highly competitive unfolding story. Whatever anybody thought of either candidate, almost everyone was fixated on this extraordinary campaign. One of the vulnerabilities of Trump, and of American conservatism generally, was that conservative candidates relied heavily on the endorsement of Rupert Murdoch, a brilliant media owner and innovator who has a near monopoly on mainstream right-wing news. At 85 on Election Day, and with a long background of deserting every politician he had ever supported and who had helped him in every country except Ronald Reagan, who was presumably assisted by the two-term limit in this respect, Murdoch was an invaluable but potentially fickle supporter, and his national American newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, had been fair, though sometimes skeptical of Trump, while his national television news network, Fox News, had been mostly supportive. On October 19th, at the third debate in Las Vegas, Trump acknowledged of Hillary, "She has experience, but it's bad experience. The experience of having got our country into this mess domestically and in the world." In the end, that appeared to be the final battle line. Trump standing for change against an establishment that had brought America to economic and strategic decline, foreign policy retreat, and a crisis of moral and historical self-doubt. And Hillary having as her only real argument that Trump was too scarily racist, sexist, and ignorant to be president. That argument certainly had its appeal to certain audiences, but it also had its limitations. Trump wasn't an extremist if you peeled the onion a little and examined him in more depth. He was moderate and sensible in most policy respects, but blunt and provocative. As he had demonstrated many times, he could capitalize on the resentment of the disaffected without frightening most of them back into the camp which had generated their discontent in the first place. In sum, he portrayed Clinton as the queen of the May in a cavalcade of national decline. Of prominent newspapers, only the Las Vegas Review-Journal, the Washington Times, and the generally scurrilous National Enquirer, in loyalty to Trump as a regular reader, endorsed Trump. USA Today, which normally did not endorse anyone, declared Trump to be erratic and accused him of having had a checkered business career and to be a serial liar, and said he was unfit for the presidency. This was a widely held view. Trump had assaulted the entire American political class, and they did not take it in good spirits or generally respect their assailant, or right to the end, have any idea what a serious threat he was to them. According to the Federal Election Commission, Clinton had outspent Trump in their presidential campaigns $564 million to $333 million. Counting the political action committees, PACs, and super PACs, Clinton outspent Trump $1,191 million to $648 million. Trump contributed about $60 million of his own money to his campaign, flew on his own aircraft, and, when possible, staged events in his own hotels and resorts. By the standards of other democratic countries, these are unimaginable amounts of money spent on an election, and the role of money in American public life is unlike anything in the history of the West. In the last debate, as on many occasions in the last stages of the campaign, Trump again declared that the political system was to a substantial degree a rigged system, and promised that if he were robbed of victory, he would contest the outcome. He was widely accused, with the usual exaggeration, of threatening to upend a fundamental pillar of American democracy, and raising the prospect that millions of his supporters may not accept the results on November 8th if Trump loses. Trump clearly enjoyed exploiting the reflex of his opponents to impute to him the most extreme intentions, and then settling things down with condescendingly placatory assurances. There was nothing alarming in his statement that he would not have the election stolen from him, and he calmly assured media questioners that he would not dispute the result if, as he expected, he won. The third debate was generally reckoned to be a draw. But on balance, Trump had considerably exceeded expectations in the debates, as it was widely anticipated that he would be eviscerated as a mere blowhard by his supposedly encyclopedically knowledgeable opponent. The irony was that November 8th would mark the beginning of a concerted effort on the part of Clinton and a large contingent of her millions of supporters to invalidate the election, an effort that continues with allegations, utterly unsupported, but pursued with dogged, if ludicrous, determination that the Russians somehow stole the election for Trump. An endless procession of Hollywood personalities attacked Trump and appeared with Clinton to try to gin up the attendance at her rallies. A catalog of their inanities would be a lengthy and painful recitation, but the most commendably original was the vocalist and all-round showman Madonna's promise to fillet any wavering male voter who went for Clinton. Trump's standing in the polls the following day rose a point, but it is not clear that the two occurrences were related. One mighty and surprising twist of the plot remained. The last drop of a tawdry, yet in a way gripping drama was about to be wrung by an unexpected player, suddenly appearing in one of American history's most portentous cameo roles. Win or lose, Donald Trump had exposed the political elites of America in the ghastly infirmity of their jaded complacency, and had offered an alternative that almost half the electorate considered to be preferable. Chapter 9. President-elect. The slugfest continued unabated into the last days of October, when the FBI director, James Comey, abruptly reappeared at center stage. On July 5th, he had purported to close the file on Hillary Clinton's misuse of a private email server while Secretary of State, and of the emails on her server that were government property, and of the truthfulness of her responses to investigators of the matter, as the Attorney General had told Comey to describe it instead of an investigation. On October 28th, 11 days before the election, he announced in letters to members of the Congress that the FBI had come upon a new batch of emails and was reopening the investigation of Mrs. Clinton. As Comey was advised by senior colleagues, it was not FBI practice to make any announcements about investigations. But Comey thought that chasing down these emails would take until after the election, that the practice was guidance rather than a firm rule, and that in the circumstances, he had to make this development known. It aroused immense controversy. The emails in question were discovered on the server of former Congressman Anthony Weiner and were between Mrs. Clinton and Weiner's estranged wife,